Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with cast member Adriana Hicks, who plays the role of Sally in the first national tour of The Color Purple at the Orpheum through May 27th. We'll also meet the director of the San Francisco Mandolin Orchestra, Akila Bokus, who shares details about the ensemble and their upcoming concerts nearby. Tenor Brian Thorsett stops by with cellist and artistic director of the Ives Collective, Stephen Harrison, to talk about The Poppy's Blow, a program with music that relates to World War I. Also, our regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson reviews the thriller Collateral, a four-part crime series set in London, currently on Netflix, and the American espionage thriller Beirut, directed by Brad Anderson, starring John Hamm. Stay with us here on Open Air at KLW. It's not often that you hear Stravinsky's Firebird arranged for mandolin orchestra, but that's just the kind of programming you'll expect to hear from the San Francisco Mandolin Orchestra, led by Akila Bokus. Milan-born Akila Bokus has lived as an American here in America for the past 9 years. He has a passion for classical music, mandolin, and the progressive rock of the 1970s, and in his free time is a student of history. After his move in 2009 here to the U.S., he teaches mandolin and conducts the San Francisco Mandolin Orchestra, a community orchestra that performs a big variety of music, as you heard. We'll also hear about their performances of Baroque music, classical music, romantic, as well as the golden era of progressive rock. Akila will be composer in residence for the annual convention of the Classical Mandolin Society of America this coming November in Santa Rosa. Their concerts this weekend will be Saturday at the Piedmont Center for the Arts, and then over the next couple of Sundays in areas nearby, which we'll talk about. Akila, welcome to Open Air.
Yeah, thanks to having me.
Of course. Well, let's first of all talk about how you decided to form an orchestra of mandolins, of all things.
Okay. As a child, I was exposed to music in the school of a mandolin orchestra. So
This is in Milano.
In Milano, yeah, in the 70s. And
is this unusual, or are there mandolin orchestras in other parts of
it? There's mandolin orchestra. The golden era of the mandolin orchestra are the 1910 and the 1920s. And but still, in the 70s in Milano, the orchestra was big, was 70 people. A huge mandolin orchestra.
Oh, that's crazy.
And and this is a tradition that recently has a sort of rediscovery because the pleasure to play music It's the real reason why you play in a mandolin orchestra.
Okay, we are special kind of person, let's say.
Yeah, community orchestra. Then there's also a little trick that is basically the mandolin is tuned like the violin. No differences in the tuning. So if you study violin as a child, and then you left the violin in a closet because you don't have the time, or things like that, you can start play the mandolin.
Transfer all the skills
in a mandolin that is a right. much simpler instrument. Mm-hmm. No bow, no intonation, no
frets. But there are frets on a mandolin.
Frets on the mandolin. The pick is relatively simple. I had some members of the orchestra that were from a violin player. They needed 3 lessons. Then they were good.
That's great. And so how did people come together? Did you just put up a sign saying we're forming a mandolin orchestra back in 2009?
The orchestra was founded in 2006, actually.
So it predates your participation.
Okay. I was part of the transformation of the orchestra that was a private business in a non-profit that I was there when it was founded. But basically, originally there were students of a mandolin player that is not in the Bay anymore, called Nicholas Wimber, that she had several students. And the students together decided, why we don't play together?
Then sure.
The things grew, and then when I arrived, the things grew even more.
Uh-huh. So how is it, what number is it now? Has it grown to in terms of participants?
Right now we are 20, 21 people. Uh-huh. Depends on the season. You know, the Bay Area is a place where people come and go. So we had several graduate students that now are in Alaska or in other part of the state.
Nice. And where do you rehearse? Where do you rehearse?
We rehearse in the public libraries, and we rehearse on Sundays. And it's to prepare the concert, we organize 8 rehearsals.
Uh-huh.
That are randomly put in some Sundays. We try to avoid long weekends.
sure, of course. Now, this particular program is called American Counterpoint. There's music by Gershwin, Bruce Graybill. A tribute to Bill Monroe. Happy birthday to Bill Monroe with guest, written by Dave Grisman.
David Grisman.
Fantastic player,
yes,
of course.
Great.
And a world premiere of one of your works. Tell us about that work.
I'm a very slow composer because it's not my primary things. So this is my 3rd piece for mandolin orchestra. And it was a long time I have this idea about event to realize it. I take my time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so the program is called American Counterpoint. How did that program come together then?
Okay. We usually have a different idea for every season. And this idea is not just, I don't wake up a morning and decide what to do. It's more a work in progress. Basically, we decide what kind of music we like to do, what kind of idea to put the music together. And we feel that was time to have an American season with American music. Okay, but then we decided to put together all of what we are, and put also the fourth fugue from the Art of Fugue of Bach as a sort of contrast, as a sort of counterpoint. Mm-hmm. From this is American counterpoint. So then Bach is absolutely an American favorite. Everyone loves Bach. There's a strong connection. In my opinion, American music is strongly related to European music. So mm-hmm. there's
So we'll have this original piece of yours, which you entitled Adagio Misterioso. Yeah. And you also do the arranging for the group, I understand.
Yes. The main part of the job is write for the orchestra. One of the reasons I do all the arranging is because mandolin is an instrument that is born to play music that is transcribed from other instrument. The fact that the mandolin is tuned like the violin, not by chance, is a project. In the 1700, to have the possibility to read all the music written for violin was the access to a huge amount of music.
Fantastic. What is your arranging medium of choice? Do you do it electronically, or
computer? I use computer. Uh-huh. I use computer, and then I arrange from basically every possible sources, from the solo piano, from the string orchestra. String orchestra is easier, because it's much similar, there's no adjustment. From the big orchestra, the Firebird was a lot of work.
George Gershwin's Prelude number 2 also on the program. And we're going to go out with great Glenn Miller 1939 hit Moonlight Serenade. That must have been fun to arrange. Achille Bocuse is the director, arranger, conductor of the San Francisco Mandolin Orchestra. sfmandolin.org if you'd like to be a participant, perhaps, and join them for a future rehearsal and concert. This Saturday, the concert is at 4 o'clock at the Piedmont Center for the Arts. It's the All Saints Episcopal Church in Palo Alto next Sunday, the 13th at 4 o'clock. Yeah. And then on the 27th, Mission Dolores here in San Francisco.
In the chapel.
sfmandolin.org for more information. Achille, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks to you.
Sound of the San Francisco Mandolin Orchestra, and a bit of music from World War II, famous Glenn Miller's 1939 hit Moonlight Serenade. sfmandolin.org for more information about their concerts over these next 3 Sundays. sfmandolin.org. Well, from a tune popular in World War II, we go to a program inspired by the 100th anniversary of World War I, presented by the Ives Collective, called The Poppies Blow. Tenor Brian Thorsett, along with the Ives Collective, will be presenting music by Sir Arthur Bliss, Joseph Sook, Ivor Gurney, and Sir Edward Elgar this weekend throughout the Bay Area here in Palo Alto in San Francisco. And joining me to talk about the concert is cellist Stephen Harrison, who is the co-artistic director of the Ives Collective, with violinist violist Susan Fryer also performing. Stephen is a longtime member of the Stanford University faculty and has been solo cellist of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players since 1985, in addition to being principal cellist at the Mendocino Music Festival and teaching at various festivals. Stephen, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. welcome back to Open Air. I understand you're a good friend of Alan Farley's.
Yeah, a long time ago. He'd known me as a kid, even.
So that's too much.
Yeah.
So happy to have you in a new conversation.
Yeah.
A pleasure to welcome back Brian Thorsett, a happily bi-coastal and then some tenor, currently on the faculty at Virginia Tech, and previously on this coast at Santa Clara University and the UC Berkeley. Brian's a graduate of the San Francisco Opera's Merula program, the Glimmerglass Opera's Young American Artist program, as well as the American Bach Soloists Academy and the Britten Pears Young Artist program in England. Since taking to the operatic stage, he has been seen and heard in over 100 diverse operatic roles, from Monteverdi to Britten, back to Rameau, and to works specifically composed for him. Very busy on other fronts as well, including art song recitals, concert appearances, commercials, film. I've had the pleasure of collaborating with him on a number of projects, including a rare performance of Mark Blitstein's Airborne Symphony. A pleasure to see him back in town for these performances. Hi, Brian.
Hey there. Wonderful to see you again.
Yeah, happy frequent flyer miles here for coming back
so.
This way. So, Stephen, let's first talk about the Ives Collective and how it formed and what's it all about.
Yeah, it's something that came out of my experiences and Susan's experiences as lifelong string quartet players. When our two members of the Ives string quartet moved on to Florida, Jody Levitz and Bettina Musumeli, Susan and I looked at each other after decades of doing this and said, do we really want to try and find two more family members again? And we looked at each other and said, you know what? No, we don't. There's a lot of music we have not been able to do, a lot of flexibility we have not been able to have. And there are a lot of people we haven't been able to play with. And we thought, what a great opportunity. People that have other main jobs, either in the symphony or, I mean, we've played with Roy Milland, the concertmaster, former concertmaster of the ballet, the Kay Stern, the concertmistress of the opera, Robin Sutherland, pianist of the San Francisco Symphony, and now Brian, where we get to do a lot of variety of things that we otherwise probably wouldn't have done. And so this is and fortunately for us, a lot of our supporters from first the Stanford String Quartet, then the Ives Quartet to the Ives Collective have come with us. So we've really been able to entertain whatever we wanted to do within reason.
Well, you've got a great brain trust at Stanford you can tap into there, too. It's fantastic. So how did you first meet up with Brian?
You know, I'd heard about Brian for years, but we happened to collaborate on a Bach Mass in B minor up in Mendocino. And there's that moment where, frankly, the conductor's kind of superfluous in a trio with with flute, tenor, and cello.
I know it well. Yeah.
That was pretty revelatory to me, Brian's insights into the music, and he really taught me in 15 minutes of rehearsal more than I could have gotten from all kinds of reading and maybe even listening. So I thought, you know, this is somebody it would be great to collaborate with. And Brian, the moment we talked about that, the list of ideas that came out was staggering. And so this program really kind of formed itself around those first conversations.
He's already got me on board for something happening next week, percolating in his brain. Brian, he just seemed to be like the feller who can't say no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel blessed to get to make music my entire life. And when you have these moments where you're in rehearsal and you kind of click with another musician and you can bounce ideas off, then that person feeds you another idea and you actually get to make music. And music's, you know, point is it's a communal thing, a way of expressing something as a community that you can't express by yourself. So when you have that opportunity to do it, you want to grasp as many of those as you can. So when Stephen said to me, hey, we have this group, I said yes, didn't let him finish sentence. You know, it's, and making chamber music is, I think, the highest level of music making you can do. It's all your ideas can be borne out, everybody has an equal say in the final product. And it keeps you alive, you know, for a musician.
I'm on your same page there,
yeah,
believe me.
Yeah.
As a flutist, it's like what keeps me going, that's for sure. Yeah. So now about this program, The Poppies Blow, how did that come together?
Well,
anniversary, of course, being
The anniversary of the end of the war. And the title comes from a poem that was written by a serviceman, somebody who served in the First World War, and actually inspired a whole installation around the Tower of London a couple of years ago, where they took literally made some 780,000 poppies that were each one depicting an English soldier who died.
That's crazy.
In the First World War.
The numbers of that war are just staggering.
Yeah, and what you find out if you've done any history is that nobody ever expected that a conflict could reach the scale that the Great War did. I mean, we can't even conceive of what the shock that must have been. People who thought they were going to war for 3 months. That's it. You know, well, this war will be over in 3 months.
The war
months.
To end all wars.
Right.
Right.
And that
really worked, didn't it?
Yeah, it really worked. And then, so then what happens, it's not like this is a concert of people who are reacting to the war, because one of the pieces, the Sukh, was written actually at the beginning of the conflict. And the Elgar was written in 1919, and their ways of dealing with the immediacy of the problem of the war. Joseph Suk was a violinist in the Bohemian String Quartet and Dvorak's son-in-law, and was asked to write a piece because they were about to play a concert for the recently conquered people, Austrian officers in the audience, and they begged Suk to write something that would inspire the people. So he wrote this thing was based on a hymn that was very popular among the Czech people. And here, you know, they had to start the concert with the Austrian national anthem. And then they come out and play this meditation, which is everybody and all the Czech members of the audience are humming along with. And the Austrian officers are going, what the heck is going on? And it's a really, really moving piece that includes this ancient hymn. There's a feeling in that piece, even without the context, but when you know the context, that you go, wow, imagine what it would have been like to be there. Mm. The Elgar Quintet is a huge piece, and that's more of a, you get a real sense that Elgar's sense of loss for a simpler, innocent time, also his youth, but also the 1880s, 1890s, even though he's writing it in 1919. It's one of his last works, even though he lived another 14 years. His last major work was the Cello Concerto, which was written around the same time. And then he basically spent all of his time going into the recording studio, recording the things that he had written that were big pieces all his life. But he didn't write anything major after 1919.
Wow.
Even though he lived another 13 years.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear some music next. Something from the Ivor Gurney. Tell us a little bit about the Ludlow and theme for tenor and string quartet, Brian.
Well, that's a piece that he actually wrote in 1920, you know, after the war. But he had been, I believe, gassed. I think that's what it was. And obviously had some very horrible effects on him. And he ended up, you know, going to an asylum later in his life and revising it several times. And the original version was for piano and voice. And then he arranged it for piano quintet. And then he kept on tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it. And this is the final version that we're about to do, is that one. And it's based on Hausmann poetry, which is the same text that Vaughan Williams used in his more famous piano quintet with tenor on One Lock Edge. And an interesting thing is a lot of these soldiers who went off to war, when the book that they tucked into their pocket was a volume of Hausmann poetry. Mm. Most of the soldiers would read that. You know, it talks about longing and love and youth and simpler things.
Wow.
And so it's very, if you think about it, Gurney, a very fine poet in his own right, you know, was thought about that as he brought a book of Hausmann poetry to the front with him.
Let's hear a little bit about a little of that Gurney piece now. Tell us we're hearing the last movement. Can you set that up for us?
It's the last movement. So this is the seventh song in the cycle called The Lent Lily.
And who are we hearing?
I believe this is James Gilchrist and the Fitzwilliam Quintet and pianist Anna Tilbrook.
Out to ramble the hill he breaks around. For under thorn and bramble, above the hollow ground, the primroses are found. And there's the wind, the chilly, with all the winds at play, and there's the lantern lily that has not long to stay, and dies on Easter Day. And since still girls go maying, you'll find the primrose still, and find the wind a playing with every wind at will. but not the daffodil. Bring baskets now and sally upon the spring's array, and bear from hill and valley the daffodil away. The spring's array, the spring's array. That dies on
of A.E. Houseman. Music by Ivor Gurney from Ludlow and Team for Tenor and String Quartet. You heard James Gilchrist there. My guest Brian Thorsett will be the tenor soloist for that work. I'm here with Stephen Harrison as well, who is the director and cellist with the Ives Collective. That is some amazing music.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And tell us just a little bit about the other movements of that Gurney piece.
Well, they're, you know, more springish movements. There's one that kind of is very of that time, and I think very apropos for what Gurney was writing for after World War One, where the, you know, you're going into a barn party and you're looking around, all the other boys are about to be marched off to war, mm-hmm. and you're shaking hands with people and not knowing if you'll ever see them again, and dancing with a girl and she gives you that look in the eye and not sure that you're going to be coming back to her. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, you know, a poem written decades and decades before had a lot of meaning to him.
The Ives Collective presents The Poppies Blow, a program inspired by the anniversary of the end of the World War I in 2018, the 100th anniversary. Music by Ivor Gurney, Sir Edward Elgar, Joseph Sook, all with connections to World War I as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. We're going to go out with some music by Sir Arthur Bliss. Let's talk about his connection to the war.
Well, he actually served in the war. Mm-hmm. And he actually, interestingly enough, we're playing this big piece by Elgar, the piano quintet. He actually was at the very first reading of that piece, even though he was very, very much younger than Elgar. He turned the pages for Elgar playing piano at the very first reading of the piano quintet's first movement. The whole piece was not done yet. And so Bliss... although this particular piece is not a response to the war, but he did serve in the war, it's actually a response to another death. Maybe you mm-hmm. can talk more.
So this piece was written after World War II. So a person who lived through the war to end all wars is writing a piece much later in 1953, I believe it was. The poetry is by Day-Lewis, Cecil, who's the father of the actor Daniel Day-Lewis.
Wow.
And this concert was a memorial concert for the pianist Noel Mutin Wood, who took his own life after his partner died, and he blamed himself for it. And so the composer Benjamin Britten, who had approved Mutin Wood as the official accompanist of Piers after he could no longer play for him, was part of this concert. The Zorian String Quartet and Britten himself at the piano gave the premiere. And Peter Pierce was the singer. And it must have been an amazing concert. The Britten Third Canticle was also premiered on that with Dennis Brain, the phenomenal horn player. And so this piece is a memorial for it. It starts with a 2-minute piano solo because Mutin Wood was very famous for his recording of the Bliss Piano Concerto. And so Bliss honored him by giving this extensive soliloquy for piano. And the poem comes in, and a fountain plays no more. And all these, the great ideas, this fount of ideas is no longer bubbling and babbling. You know, it's been put out. And the ending of this piece is one of the most heartrending endings in any piece of vocal chamber music, and I won't give it away. But it's one of the most difficult things to sing in terms of connection to a text.
Wow, well, let's hear it now. Yeah. We'll also hear James Gilchrist sing this movement, this portion of the elegiac sonnet of Sir Arthur Bliss, with text by Daniel Day-Lewis's dad. Fascinating. Stephen Morrison, we look forward to hearing more about the Ives Collective down the road, interesting events, and more about the ensemble at ivescollective.org. BrianThorsett.com. Look forward to your next project out west here. Please come back and see us, and we'll talk about some more Elgar next year. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Pleasure to be here.
Music of Sir Arthur Bliss to go out. Just a portion of the elegiac sonnet by Sir Arthur Bliss. You heard James Gilchrist there singing the text of Daniel Day-Lewis's dad for this elegiac sonnet. And the concerts of the Ives Collective of these concerts will be on this coming Sunday at St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Palo Alto. And May 4th, which is tomorrow night at St. Mark's in Palo Alto. And then Sunday, this coming Sunday at 4 p.m. as part of Old First Concerts presentation here in San Francisco. More information at ivescollective.org. And the prolific Brian Thorsett's activities, visit Brian Thorsett, BrianThorsett.com. We'll have links to those sites at our website, klw.org, in the open air page. Great stuff. Try to catch it if you can. I'm David LaTulipe. You are listening to Open Air here on KLW. Still to come, a talk with Adriana Hicks, who performs the lead of Selly in The Color Purple, being presented in its first national tour at the Orpheum. And next, a chat with our regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson. Peter, welcome back to our airwaves, and tell us what you got for us this week.
Yeah, hi, David. Good to be here. And I'm going to be looking at two different style of movies. First is available through the Netflix, and it is a BBC production called Collateral. And I mention what I call the golden age of television is that some great individual movies are being produced both by the BBC and then available over here through different style of outlets. There's Amazon Prime, there's Acorn, and there's Netflix. So Collateral, I think, is particularly important in terms of our problems to do with immigration. And this is the playwright David Herr. David Herr has a great reputation. I think he's one of the great living playwrights of the contemporary world. And he brings together really three different stories. Essentially a murder story, a story about the issues facing immigrants, particularly Syrian immigrants in contemporary Britain, and then, of course, the almighty Secret Service, British intelligence, who manage to scramble everywhere and quite often really do manage to muck things up. So at the center of the story is Detective Inspector, played incidentally by Carrie Mulligan, and she is simply known as Glaspie. and she is set out on an investigation about the death of a pizza delivery man. The pizza delivery man is actually a non-British citizen, so straight away the story of immigration comes in. And one of the things about David Hare is that he can go the full range of the political scene. In this case, he focuses on a left-wing Labour politician. He throws in for good mix a lesbian vicar, so you have gender issues, and then at the heart of the story of the murder of an immigrant, which of course leads to an investigation of the immigrant's family, and here are two sisters at the centre of the drama. Now, this may sound very far-fetched and far-reaching, but David Hare is such a good playwright, he brings together all the different threads of the story. And so while you've got gender issues floating around, you have straightforward police investigation work. And in the making of the film, making of the series, it's a two-part series, two-part episodes, there's just that sense of the Robert Altman type of filming. The word collateral, I think, is interesting. In contemporary terms, we've often seen it in relation to collateral damage, where if you have surgical strikes in a bombing, civilians get injured, dead, suffer, whatever. And I think, again, the title Collateral is intentional because it's all-embracing. And I mentioned the British intelligence. They are behind the plot, partly to cover things up, keep things quiet, while Carrie Mulligan, the police investigator, wants simply to solve a crime. Highly recommended. It runs for two episodes. The title is Collateral. It is produced by the BBC, and it is, as I say, available now in this country, depending on which additional services you have. Highly recommended, the title Collateral. Now, we're going to move from the home screen, the small screen, to the big screen with a contemporary thriller simply under the name of the city, Beirut. And this is a tense, moody thriller set in Lebanon in 1982, in the years which lead up to the Lebanese Civil War. It's historic in the sense it precedes the Civil War, and directed by Brad Anderson and scripted by Tony Gilroy, it really explains some of the many differences of those different groups who were all operating in the shadows. So you have the Russians, you have, they don't mention it, Hezbollah, you have both the Palestinians, the Arabs, and of course, at the heart of the story is the American embassy. This is a story that combines politics with international diplomacy and, of course, with kidnapping. And the story is sent on the release of an American kidnapped, and they bring an old-time dab hand, played intentionally by a low-key American actor. His name is Ham, H-A-M-M, and he effectively is there as the negotiator, but he's left the CIA. He's gone into the whole area of mediation, but he's called back to save the day. So in this sense, it's a Beirut of over 40 years ago. And in fact, one of the complaints of the film is they had to shoot it in Morocco because Beirut is now coming back into the city it used to be. They used to call it the Paris of the Middle East. There are also hints of John le Carré here. You don't know quite who is on whose side and who is fighting for what. So that confusion that comes with Civil War dramas is very much alive in the Beirut story. And at the same time, the minor characters also bring a real sense of reality to the story. Rosamund Pike is the handler. And as the story gradually evolves, what finally comes out of it is one of those Checkpoint Charlie type of exchanges. It happens at this time at an airport. I certainly won't ruin the ending for you, but you'll stay in your seat as you watch it. So those are two of my choices for this week. One is to stay at home, download the BBC presentation of Collateral, and you'll get a good insight on murder, immigration and politics. Or go to the big screen and look at Beirut. Beirut, the story, a spy thriller set in the 1980s during the build-up to the Lebanese Civil War.
John Hamm featured in the cast of Beirut. And here in the Bay Area, you can catch Beirut at the 4-star on Clement and the AMC Kabuki 8 right now. And I'm sure at a theater near you soon if you're not nearby those couple. Thank you, Peter.
Okay, good to be with you, David.
We'll see you in a couple weeks talking about Shakespeare, I believe.
That's right. Brush up your Shakespeare.
With Philippa Kelly. We're looking forward to that.
Okay.
Well, my next guest is featured prominently in the production at the Orpheum Theater here in San Francisco. Her performance credits, Adriana Hicks, include singing backup for Michael Bublé, as well as regional and international performances in Sister Act, Legally Blonde, Ragtime, and Buddy Holly. And her Great White Way Broadway credits include playing the fortune teller and Jasmine's attendant in Aladdin, and being a part of the swing cast for the 2016 Tony Award-winning revival of a musical, The Color Purple, for which she now takes the lead of Sally, a role that garnered an Academy Award for Whoopi Goldberg in the Steven Spielberg-directed movie from 1985. This is the very first national tour of The Color Purple, now at the Orpheum here in San Francisco through the 27th, and Texas native Adriana Hicks' first national tour as well. A pleasure to welcome Adriana to our airwaves.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for taking time from the production to take a little time with us here on the air.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, let's back up to Broadway. And I understand that as a swing in that production, you had to cover or be ready for 7 different roles.
I did.
What was that like?
It was all of the feelings. I always say that because it was just a wild ride of just so much fun and joy and laughter, times of great, you know, striving and trying to make sure I got everything right. But it definitely has prepared me to be where I am today, which I'm really, really grateful for.
Of course. Now, that certainly overfamiliarized you with the musical and in terms of where you
right.
everything else that's going on.
Right.
Now, believe it or not, there might be some listening here that are not familiar with the story of The Color Purple, which is based on the 1982 novel by American writer Alice Walker, who subsequently won the Pulitzer and National Book Award for Fiction. If you can, just tell us the story in a nutshell.
Yeah, so The Color Purple follows the story of Celie, who is the main character in the show, and she is a woman who has faced various trials and tribulations, including being married off at a very young age and also having her sister separated from her, and how she overcomes all of the trials that's been given to her in life, and she encounters beautiful women along the way to help empower her to self-worth, self-love, and knowing that there is so much more in this earth than just being here holding your head down, but actually there's hope at the end of the tunnel. She's a wonderful, remarkable woman.
Nice. And the book was adapted for a musical by Marcia Norman, who herself won a Pulitzer for her play Night Mother, and a Tony for The Secret Garden on Broadway, mm-hmm. and a Tony nomination for the book for The Color Purple.
Yes, Marcia's incredible.
And then, the music involved, a couple of different composer lyricists, and they include Grammy-nominated Brendel Russell, Grammy-winning and Emmy-nominated Ali Willis, that Emmy nomination for the Friends theme mm-hmm. song, and Stephen Bray, who has a number of top 10 songs for Madonna under his belt. So that's quite a soundtrack to live up to. Let's talk about that musical score a little bit. That has all kinds of influences, jazz, gospel, blues, African.
Absolutely. It's really wonderful to be able to immerse myself in what they have created in this show every single night, because it literally takes you on a journey throughout, Black music as well, what it has brought to our culture and to the nations, and even experiencing a little bit of operatic stuff as well. It's really, really awesome to see And sing that every single night. It gets the audiences definitely feeling all everything, you know, which is wonderful. It's very heart-wrenching. It's very, it touches the soul, I like to say. It's pretty much like a spiritual experience that they have created with the music.
Now you have to hit some pretty high notes.
Yeah.
How do you take care of your voice after a performance night after night?
I love sleep. Sleep is the best. Sleeping and just really listening to my body. You know, it is interesting what we do every night. It's a very athletic thing that we're called to do, you know, and understanding that, you know, I have my tea, I have my water, and you just go take it day by day, really, literally second by second. You know, there are moments where I'm like, God, I don't know if I'm going to hit this note tonight, until I actually get to what the count right before it. I'm like, okay, I can hit it or I can't. You know, it's just, it's amazing the journey that I really go through with this. But, you know, you just take it one step at a time, like any person, you know, anybody could do.
I have no commercial interest in this, but throat coat tea is a great tea.
Yes, you know, I used to love that tea, but now I've kind of like strayed away from it because I try other things. I love chamomile tea now. It's a different variety of stuff.
So you talk about the journey of your voice. Let's talk about the journey of Celia, your character. What is she going through, and how does her character develop throughout The Color Purple?
You know, it's crazy. Like, my brain literally stops with this question because it just, she literally goes through every single feeling that the human experience has, you know? And I, just starting out as a young child, just being in a difficult place of having children very, very young, at 14 years old, and she is a genuine person. That's one thing that I discovered about her is that she's very selfless, and she's willing to give up her all for her sister, for the people that she loves. And as she goes through that journey, as great as that is, she sometimes like depletes herself, you know, from really experiencing and getting what she needs in order to keep going, you know, besides the love for her sister. And because she just hasn't like fully evolved into herself and loving herself. But as the journey goes on and she meets these wonderful women in Shook Avery and in Sophia, who empower her, she realizes that she has a voice, that she is just not here just to have her head down to work for whoever is over her. You know, she has a voice. She is beautiful. And by the end of the story, she's very triumphant. She's almost like a phoenix, I like to say, who rises from the ashes. You know, when everything else is done, you know, you think, what else could happen to this poor woman? But she's able to find the glimmer of hope in the middle of a hopeless world.
Well, that must take a lot out of you night after night, too.
You know?
Any personal connection to this sort of story?
Yeah, it's great to see how with Celia, and with the story, you know, her insecurities, like we all have, just in wanting to know that she has a place in this world and wanting to know, you know, that there is hope at the end of the tunnel. And like, I feel like I've experienced that in my life. When life hits you hard, you know, you want to know that there's a reason for living. You want to know that there's a reason to keep going. And when you find that inner voice, you know, that's what definitely Celia has taught me, what I've learned and gleaned from her. And that I'm beautiful, you know, to be able to say that every single night is a constant reminder, like, yes, you are beautiful, Adrianna Lachey Hicks. You are here for a reason and a purpose, and you must keep going because it's a story that's to be told that's much bigger than yourself.
Tell us a little bit about your family. Have they seen the show? Or?
Yeah.
Oh,
I love my family. They're so great. I actually have family here. I was born in Stockton, California, and but didn't live here very, very long. I moved to Texas after that, and I have family still here, my godparents, so they're coming out, and my cousins, and my mom has seen the show numerous times.
Is she it's a incredible. Stage mom, or is she always just totally supportive?
You know, she's just really supportive, and she's both. You know, she's like, she's wonderful, and like, she's like my hero. I love my mother, and unfortunately, my father passed away before I started the Broadway production back in 2015, but that was always his goal or his dream for me. He would always say, you know, whenever you get that 5 to 10 year ticket on Broadway, and I'll be like, Dad, that's really cute, but like, that doesn't happen unless you're a Hamilton or Wicked or whatever, you know, but I would just, you know, disappoint him. He's like, no, but when you get it, it's just going to be uphill for you, and it's just going to be, you know, just constant for you. And before he passed away, it was right when I started the Color Purple was when I was right before he passed away. Yeah, it was really crazy. But I know he's happy that I'm here right
now.
I'm
sorry for your loss, but I'm sure, again, he's looking down with beaming eyes.
Yeah.
So this is your first national tour.
Yes.
That's got to be another endurance test.
Yes, I love it. But I've always loved to travel. So that's been great. And it has been a wonderful experience to be able to, one, see my country, you know, because I've lived overseas and seen the world, but I have not seen the United States of America. So that was always, that's always been an element to help me get through this, because it's so fun to be able to go to a new city every single week or every 2 weeks or now every month. You know, it's been really great.
And I'm sure the challenge is there. You want to explore the city, but you've also got to remember that you've got some performances.
Right. The job comes first.
Every audience is like the first time seeing it, and you got to be right on top of it, 120%. So when for you did the musical theater bug bite?
Oh, it was back in high school. I'll never forget this. I saw my first musical production, because I've always been immersed in music and singing, and I played the flute when I was younger.
Me too.
Yeah,
I heard. I still do.
That's amazing. I played it for 6 years, and I even played it in high school, but I saw my first musical production in high school, sophomore year, and it was Guys and Dolls, and they did a fantastic job, and I just remember sitting in the first two rows like, what? This is what I've been missing? This is what I want to do, because I would always switch. I want to be a dancer. I want to be a singer. I want to play an instrument. But to know that this particular profession incorporates it all, I said, well, this is what I think I need to do. Yeah.
Well, describe for me a little bit what we'll see on stage. There are chairs hanging from the backdrop, and they're constantly being moved around by cast members.
Yeah, well, expect to see a very minimalistic approach to this musical, which is very... I think is one of the best elements that you could have added to this story, for sure. Our director, John Doyle, was really wonderful in his vision. And yeah, it's nothing but chairs, a couple of baskets, a few sheets to help tell the story that needs to be told, and us. And thankfully, it's amazing to see how that's always been enough. You know, it always constantly reminds us of that in the show, which I'm grateful for.
Mm-hmm. Since you've played so many roles, Celie must be the top role that you want to play. Are there other roles that you'd like to also maybe dip into?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So I would love to play Mrs. Lovett in Sweeney Todd.
Oh, okay.
Which is random, I know, but I love immersing myself in things that are just like, people are like, well, why would you want to play that? I'm like, no, it's incredible. That, and I would love to play the witch or the baker's wife Into the Woods. Yeah,
yeah,
those are my top ones. And also Aida, that was like my favorite musical. So yeah, I have a few up there.
Doing Celie, is there anything you'd like to go back to in The Color Purple down the road, or is that's the one role?
That's the one.
Yeah,
Celie definitely has challenged me and helped me to be like, no, you need to keep pushing. There's no going back.
Well, there are three ladies who comment on the action, like sort of like a Greek chorus in The Color Purple, the church ladies.
Yeah.
Tell us about them.
They're wonderful. I mean, you know, it's just brilliant. It's just, it's awesome to have women, you know, experience all of the things that Celie goes through and to have the comment on it, because it's like, you know, you see the woman in church and you see the gossip lady on the street who's like, girl, did you hear about this? Did you hear about that? Well, let me tell you what happened about this. And it's funny how we, you know, you see that in real life, you know, that, and you discover how people are just people. And with these women, it's awesome to have like that underlying narrative with them, because it brings a little bit of light to a heavy a heavy story that we're telling every night.
Right, and speaking of lightening things up, the church ladies are involved with helping promote tickets for the show.
Yeah. they, it's perfect.
So I think one of them was exclaimed, child, it ain't that hard. Here's how you get tickets.
Oh, child, yes.
I should also mention that the wonderful purveyor of ice creams here in San Francisco, Humphrey Slocum, has partnered with HSN, SHN, and The Color Purple to present The Color Purple ice cream flavor.
Yeah, I can't wait to try it.
So for the entire month of 2018, a limited edition ice cream flavor. Let's see, it's got organic blackberry puree, whole dried hibiscus flowers, which help for that beautiful purple color, and some herbs that linger a little bit after the last bite. Visit Humphrey Slocum, but more important, catch The Color Purple at the Orpheum. from until the 27th of this month. All sorts of wonderful events around it. Information at shnsf.com. Celia Hicks, I wish you a wonderful performance and a run here. What other cities are you looking forward to explore in this tour?
I can't wait to go to L.A. and Chicago, and we ended out in Washington, so it's a good run all the way to the end. I can't wait to see those cities.
Here's a little bit of Ms. Seeley's blues from the movie version of The Color Purple. Thanks for coming in, Seeley.
Thank you. Something to tell you something, sister. Remember your name, no twister. Gonna steal your stuff away, my sister. We sure ain't got a whole lot of time. So
Ms. Seeley's blues from the movie version of The Color Purple. Color Purple runs at the Orpheum Theater here on Market Street in San Francisco through the 27th. shnsf.com for more information. The wonderful Adriana Hicks in the lead role of Seeley. Well, at some point in the near future, we do hope to have on the Rova Saxophone Quartet. They're celebrating their 40th anniversary and CD release concert on upcoming performances on Friday and on the 12th of May. Information at Rova Sax Quartet. Go to brownpapertickets.com for more information about those concerts. I'm David Latulip. It's been a pleasure having these folks on this edition of Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. Join us next week for more information about the wonderful performing arts scene here in the Bay Area. I'm David Latulip. Thanks so much for listening to it.